This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today is the last day for acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey in her tenure in office. Tomorrow, it's Michelle Wu. She'll be sworn in, and at that point, all eyes will be on her to see if she can deliver on the big, bold promises that she made during the campaign. Well, it is today, though, so we want to take some time to acknowledge the historic nature of Janey's time in office and what it's meant for the city. We're going to talk to a couple of people. First, WBUR's Callum Borchers. Hey, Callum, welcome back.
Hey there, Tiziana. Good to be back.
So what is the headline of Kim Janey's 7 months in office?
Well, I think there's little doubt the headline is that she was the first woman and first person of color to lead Boston. This makes her a significant figure, perhaps especially for young women of color who finally got to see someone who looks like them in the mayor's office. You know, I'm thinking of people like Deanna Cook, who's a student at UMass. Here's what she told me about it.
Honestly, having Kim Janey become the first woman and the first person of color to lead Boston as interim mayor is a huge triumph for the city of Boston. We always need more women leaders, especially leaders of color, and I cannot think of a better leading lady than Kim.
So, you know, there's tremendous symbolic value to Janey's tenure, but let's remember, she wasn't content with just making history as soon as she took the oath of office. She did govern, too.
Well, let's talk about that. What in her short-term time in office, Cal, you've covered politics for a long time. What stands out for you on the governing side of this equation?
I think what stands out is that Janey was strategic. You know, she picked things she could accomplish pretty quickly that also might have a lasting impact. For instance, she added LGBTQ-owned businesses to an existing diversity program for city contractors. That could prove to be a big break for some entrepreneurs. She formalized Boston's recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day. Boston may still be marking that day decades from now because of Janey's change. She also used $500,000 in the city's existing budget to pilot a free bus route between Mattapan and Ruggles. And we know that Michelle Wu wants to make the tea free throughout Boston. If she ends up being successful, she'll have Janey's experiment partly to thank.
Sometimes a mayor really owns an issue. I know we're talking about 7 months here, but do you think Janey really took ownership of any particular issues during her time?
Well, I mean, the Dennis White saga comes to mind, right? I mean, he was the police commissioner accused of domestic violence. She inherited that problem. He was already on suspension when Janey took office. She could have just left him there until after the election. In fact, there were some legal experts who questioned whether she even had the authority as acting mayor to decide his fate. The argument was that an elected mayor should make that call. But Janey took charge and fired him. People could debate whether that was the right thing to do, of course, Tiziana, but you asked if she took ownership, and she certainly took ownership of that issue.
So you've noticed, you know, the symbolism, the historic nature, of course, also during an historic time. She becomes acting mayor during a pandemic. How did that affect things and complicate things?
I mean, the pandemic was a major complication in labor relations for all levels of government. We saw this at the state level when Governor Charlie Baker ordered some 42,000 state workers under his authority to get vaccinated unless they qualified for medical or religious waivers. You know, the unions sued in response, at least some of them did. And now the state did win those cases, but Janey avoided these kinds of conflicts altogether by being more flexible. She gave City of Boston employees the option to get vaccinated or submit to weekly testing. I talked to Eric Berg about this. He's the executive vice president of the Boston Teachers Union.
Being included in the discussions, being included in the decisions, for instance, you know, we negotiated time off to get vaccinated or tested and so forth. Those are all important things to our members, and we think that the policy is more effective and our schools are safer because of it. And that's a tribute to Mayor Janey's approach, frankly.
And Berg told me, Tiziana, that he's hoping Janey's approach is going to set a cooperative example for the next administration, too.
Often during her time, she has kept her cards close to her vest, Callum. It's time to think about what comes next. Has she given any hints about that publicly?
Boy, I wish. You know, I was hoping that she might hint at what she'll do next in her farewell address last week, Tiziana, but alas, she did not. I think it's a pretty safe bet that she'll have some appealing opportunities in the private sector if she does want to go that route. Of course, she could run for mayor again in 4 years, but I'd be kind of surprised if she challenged Wu after endorsing her so enthusiastically this year. And remember, Wu was only 36, so she could hold on to that mayor's seat for a long time.
And Callum, I don't know if we know this, but does she have any remaining role on the city council, having, you know, she was the president of the city council, then acting mayor? Is that just over?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, it was funny, but you know, there was not a requirement for city councilors running for mayor to give up their seats. It was one of the questions I put to all of those candidates, whether it was Azabi George or Andrea Campbell or Michelle Wu early in the race, will you actually give up your seat in order to seek the mayor's office so you don't kind of look like you're hedging your bets? And they all said yes, they would give up those seats. And of course, there is a new District 7 councilor coming in to replace Kim Janey. So yeah, we're sort of left to wonder what she'll do next. She's been active in the Wu transition, which of course was quicker, just 2 weeks, than a normal transition would be in January.
Of course, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes with WBUR's Anthony Brooks. But that has been WBUR's Callum Borchers about Kim Janey. Callum, thanks a lot.
Glad to be with you.
All right, so we want to add another voice here. We're joined by Boston Globe culture columnist Janae Osterholt. Janae, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote a piece as part of your series of A Beautiful Resistance about specifically Kim Janey and her historic space in the mayor's office. And I want to start by asking you personally, Kim Janey's behind the podium last March. She's being sworn in. What did it mean to you in that moment?
You know, it was, it meant so much to me in that moment. And I am someone who has always firmly believed in Michelle Wu and was very excited also when Andrea came along. And Kim is also someone who I thought was amazing on the city council. So it's like having all these amazing women who I believe in, who I know care about our city, but to actually see not just a woman of color, not just a woman, but a Black woman, a daughter of Roxbury, become mayor. It means so much. And I know what it means for the people in this city who were born here, who grew up here, and even someone like me who moved here and adopted this as my home. To see a Black woman take that seat in a city that is nearly a quarter Black, that has been perceived as white and parochial and unwelcoming, to have that representation was to crack the door open. It was to turn a page. It was to give a glimmer of hope and to become a mirror and a portal for what is possible and what is next. And I believe it only fueled the possibilities for the race that we saw and eventually the win that we saw with Michelle Wu, like seeing what is possible, seeing what a Black woman did. All of that stuff that Kel just named, like in 7 months, that is a lot for someone who was not planning to be mayor, who didn't even build a campaign until, you know, March, April. Like, I just don't want that ever to be underestimated. No, she did not make it past the primary, but she did a lot in 7 months, and she did a lot for someone who this was not their goal initially.
You know, you talk in your piece, I guess these are my words, but it feels like you're really trying to get across the wear and tear of being the first at something. Not just the wear and tear of breaking through the barrier, metaphorically, but then occupying that space as the first. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, I wrote, after my piece on Kim, my next piece literally was about what Black excellence means in a silo, like what it means when you're the first, what it means when you're the only, what it means when you're one of a few. People don't think about the emotional violence and the visual violence of not being represented, not being seen, and not being able to look across your office and see people in power who look like you. It is a second job to navigate that. And you're talking about a Black woman, not just a woman of color, which being a woman of color is also hard, but being a Black woman specifically in a city with this many Black people that has managed to stay this parochial and this white for this long when it comes to the power structures, that is a everyday wrestling match. And we saw it from the moment that she took seat, the way that people wanted to rush to remind her that she was acting mayor, as if she wasn't literally taking on and inheriting a bunch of stuff from Marty and the pandemic, in all types of complicated situations that she was never prepared. to have happened to her, yet she went in with both feet and thinking strong and trying really hard to make smart decisions while dealing with racism, while dealing with sexism. It's not an easy task, not for her or not for anybody, you know, not for Rollins, not for Bud. I mean, not for so many people who are dealing with this every single day, whatever their career is. And even in how we're seeing the narrative being framed around the VP right now, as if she is the bad guy in the White House. And not that she is my favorite politician by any means, but there is a very sexist, racist narrative coming out of those criticisms.
So I just want to note for listeners, Rollins, of course, being Rachel Rollins, district attorney, and Chief Justice Bud of the Supreme Judicial Court there. So I want to look at Janie's time in office. Do you feel there was a signature? Signature is a little shallow. Do you feel there was an issue on which she led that was particularly important for her to lead on, or where she particularly could because she was the first woman and the first person of color in the mayor's office, or where people sort of forced her into dealing with that issue explicitly?
I mean, obviously, I think about the stuff with her firing. The whole police situation, I feel like everyone had their eyes on that, not just because of the controversy and the scandal and the abuse, but also like it's the police, it's a Black person, it's a Black woman. There's all these other dynamics involved in her taking him on. And she owned it. And I don't, you know, there was lots of controversy around whether she should have or should not have, but I do think that she was in a unique position. And I think coming out of the summer we had before that and her having that dumped on her lap was a lot of mess to have to take on, and especially to take on as a Black woman and a Black woman who was born and raised in Roxbury during an era. You know, we're still in that era, but this is a woman who for decades has grown up in a city dealing with these types of police power abuses. So that, and also I agree with the power given to teachers when we talk about negotiations.
We're talking to Boston Globe culture columnist Janae Osterholt. Janae, best and worst moments of Kim Janey's 7 months?
Worst was for sure the comment, the COVID comment about masking and mask mandates. That was enraging. Not cool.
When she made a loose comparison to the time of slavery and identification papers.
Absolutely. I also thought the her and Andrea back and forth was not great. But best is the way that she took on being in community with the community, and not just as part of her campaign, but as mayor. You know, I walked with Kim through the streets of Roxbury. I walked with Kim outside of City Hall. And I know there's a lot of best things that we can say about things that, you know, like the bus route and all types of things that she helped make possible and continues to make possible. Even here on her last day, she's like passing, you know, passing monies to be spent for different things that are positive for the community. But to see her and to see people in this community yell like, you know, hey, Mayor Janey, and see her flash her smile and like sit with people, ride the bus with them, and really make people see what is possible. And I know people will say, oh, that's so Hallmark, that's so cheesy. But in a city like this, where so for generations, people have thought it was impossible to change the power structure and impossible for a community primarily made up of people of color, a quarter of them Black, to not feel like they have the power or even the physical space to be welcome in their own city, to have a Black woman going all through the greater Boston area on the bus, in the neighborhoods, you know, block by block, in community with the community, for me was probably the best and most proudful thing, because I know the power of that. And I know what it means for little Black girls, little Black boys, little Black thems, and also other people of color, and just girls and femmes, period. Like, that is going to create, you know, when Michelle made that acceptance speech and she said her son asked, you know, can boys run for mayor? It was very funny, but it also was amazing to me, because this is the possibilities that we are planting. We are making it so the next generation is going to feel like power is available to them, and it is everybody's, and democracy is real. And Kim helped make that happen.
So, Janae, one of the themes I feel like I've encountered a lot in A Beautiful Resistance, in your work there, is the idea of resisting erasure. And, you know, the history books will get written, and I wonder if there's something that you think it's particularly important does not get erased about acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey's tenure when the history's written. Say it again.
That she was here. You know, I wrote the piece I wrote, and the headline was like, you know, Kim Janey mattered. And I wrote that because I knew when Michelle won, and I love Michelle. I am definitely, you know, part of the Wu train. I'm all aboard. But I knew that when Michelle won, the inclination would be first woman, first person of color to do this. And yes, she is the first woman, first person of color, first transplant, first Asian to be elected mayor. And I understand that election matters. And I understand that power and that history and Michelle matters, and I'm so proud of her and proud for our city. But I do not want Kim's history-making turn as the first woman, first Black person, first Black woman to be in that office as mayor, actually governing our city through a pandemic, through a police scandal, through so many things, whether you voted for her or not. The respect is due, and we just cannot. It's not Michelle at the cost of Kim. It's Michelle and Kim made history. Michelle and Kim made history. So when the history books are written, I don't want what happens to so many Black women to happen, in which we get erased out of the narrative of things that we helped bust open.
All right. That is Boston Globe culture columnist Janae Osterholt. You can check out season 2 of her series, A Beautiful Resistance, including her conversation with Mayor Kim Janey, on our website, RadioBoston.org. Janae, it's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good day.
You too. So, we've talked about Kim Janey. Today is her last day. She'll be walking out of City Hall. But Michelle Wu will be walking into it, and tomorrow she'll be sworn in. So we turn now to WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who will attend Wu's swearing-in tomorrow, to give us a little bit of a sneak preview. Anthony, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be here.
So before we turn to Wu, I know you've heard a lot of what we've been talking about. Any reactions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was struck and frankly quite moved by the way Janae, you know, made the point about the significance of Janey's historic role in the city, in particular what it meant for so many young Black girls who saw themselves in her. That was a first. And it's important as well to remember that Janey was making a difference before her brief tenure as mayor. I mean, this daughter of Roxbury was a city councilor. She was president of the city council. And in her piece for The Globe, Janae quoted Attorney General Maura Healey, who said, in becoming this sort of historic mayor of Boston, it was a moment that marked the beginning of a new Boston. And I think that's really important to remember. And I appreciated everything Janae said about Mayor Janey.
So we've heard a number of people refer to Michelle Wu's election as reflecting that new Boston. Tomorrow she gets sworn in. She's had 2 weeks. Help us get our minds around how hard it would be to take over a city 2 weeks after you're elected.
Yeah, I mean, usually transitions last 2 months. And that's for good reason, because these folks have to assemble a team. There's a lot of sort of catching up that has to happen. But because of the departure of Marty Walsh, Wu had just 2 weeks from Election Day to her swearing in instead of that usual 2 months. So starting tomorrow, she's going to have to run the city while continuing to assemble her team. And it, to me, it feels sort of like building an airplane while you're taking off. It will help Wu that she's been a city councilor for the past 8 years. It will help her that she worked for Tom Menino, so she knows her way around City Hall. Still, it's a huge challenge. She's going to be facing some big issues, including the crisis of addiction and homelessness at Mass and Cass, while she's assembling her team and governing the city on a day-to-day basis. And she knows it. And that's why this is a brief ceremony tomorrow. And it's why she said right after she's sworn in, she's heading to the mayor's chambers, and she's starting work because she says there's no time to waste.
So to that point, I think I can't count the number of times during the campaign season that we heard a candidate say on day one, on the first 100 days, on my first day. So tomorrow's the first day. Where do you think she's going to focus?
Well, she's already signaled that one of her top priorities for the new administration is tackling the crisis at Mass and Cass, the crisis of addiction and homelessness that's playing out there. And last week, she's already named a cabinet-level senior advisor to lead the city's response to this. So that's clearly a priority. And it's probably going to be the priority of the early days. And she's going to have a lot of other issues on her plate. But that particular humanitarian crisis is so visible. It's on the streets as we speak right now. So it makes sense that she's tackling this one right away.
The other thing that's been on my mind, Anthony, you've said during your analysis with us a number of times over the last several weeks that she has made huge promises. And, criticism has been that those promises are well beyond the purview of the mayor's office. So can she deliver on them? And what obstacles do you anticipate might be in the way?
Well, the short answer is yes, she can deliver on them. But of course, they are challenges. And like any new mayor, she's going to face headwinds that come from entrenched political interests and money, frankly. I'm thinking of two promises in particular. We've talked about them a lot on this show. First, the promise to make public transportation free in the city of Boston. And the challenge there is it's the state, not City Hall, that funds the MBTA. And so far, legislative leaders on Beacon Hill, including Charlie Baker, have been pretty cool to the idea. Wu will also face opposition to her promise to bring back rent control, which Massachusetts outlawed in a referendum in 1994. So that will also need state approval. But that doesn't mean these things aren't doable. It just means she's going to have to work really hard to convince other people to come along with her. And that's what good political leaders do. It means she's going to have to work outside of City Hall and persuade state leaders to come along. And that will be interesting to watch if she can do that. But so, there's the challenge.
So you're going to watch a lot of things, I'm sure. You're going to be in the room tomorrow. In these first couple weeks, what are you going to watch most closely, Anthony?
Well, I think, the first big test for any administration is who is going to join the administration. And she's still assembling her team. So that's going to be, I think, one of the most interesting things to watch in these first days. Who is coming aboard to help her govern the city of Boston? So that's what I'll be watching. And then, I'll be watching all of the above, how she's going to tackle these big issues that she has been talking about for months and months now. It's going to be fascinating to watch. This is a historic moment for Boston. I'm also fascinated by this idea of a 36-year-old mayor, a millennial, someone who has kids in school, who is going to be, living and governing around those issues that are so important to so many people in the city.
Well, I am looking forward to future conversations we're going to have about that. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, always fantastic. Thanks, Anthony.
Sure, my pleasure.
The Boston Public Schools have been locked in a battle with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, and it's over how long the Curly K-8 school in Jamaica Plain can offer remote learning after the school shut down due to a severe COVID outbreak. Okay, it's a technical fight about how many days of instruction will count. Boston wants 7. The state's only granting 4. But at its heart, it is a power struggle over local control by a school district, even parents and families, versus the state. The Boston Teachers Union, well, it is siding with the Boston Public Schools. Here's Union Vice President Eric Berg.
I want to be teaching in person every day. But when our public health officials warn about the safety of doing so, we need the state to listen.
At the end of the day, though, and really all through every day of a closure, it is the parents and the kids who are living it. Krista Magnuson is a parent of a sixth grader at the Curley School and joins us now. Krista, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how has this temporary shutdown been going so far, Krista?
I mean, it's been all right for my family in that we are in the lucky position of having, you know, parents who either work from home or work mostly from home and are free to supervise our child. It's a little stressful, you know. My kid is an extrovert and is not super psyched to be at home doing remote learning right now. But it's manageable.
How many days of remote learning has he had so far?
This is the third. Yeah, they were closed for 2 days last week plus a holiday and then today.
And there are going to be seven altogether, correct?
Yeah, it'll be the rest of the week.
Is he going to go just bonkers?
Well, you could argue that he's lightly bonkers already, so that's an unfair to place all that on the school. But he'll be okay. He is, you know, it helps to be able to see his classmates on Zoom, and of course, like then he and his friends after school do the same thing. They get on their phones or on Zoom and participate in, you know, video games and whatnot with each other at that point.
So, Krista, I wondered, you know, as the outbreak begins to spread and it's starting to look like the school is going to close down, and then you hear the school is going to close down, does it feel like a slow-moving nightmare? Did it ever occur to you in the fall that you might actually be back to remote learning with your kid at home?
Honestly, absolutely it did. Because after school got underway, you know, I think some schools were, you know, not having staffing issues in terms of handling pooled testing and rapid testing, but some schools were, and this isn't, you know, that information has been traveling the parent network for some time. And so it did seem plausible that at some point, at least some schools would need to take a break to get back on top of things.
Was your son testing regularly through school?
He was. It does seem like the Curley was doing a pretty good job with pooled testing. It's just unfortunate that, you know, they didn't have the capacity to keep on top of the rapid testing for the test and stay program. I don't know, like they were, at one point they were trying to deliver 500 rapid tests a day, which is, you know, more than half the school population, and that's just not tenable.
So have you been happy with the way the school, I mean, we're going to dive into the policy gnarliness here now, but I want to start with, as communication started to flow, were you happy with the communication you received? When did you find out the school was going to be closing down? How much notice did you have? Do you think the school should have done anything differently? Sort of size that up for us.
We didn't have a lot of notice that the school would close down. I don't think anybody got a lot of notice.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what does that mean? Is that 12 hours? Is it 3 days?
Oh, it was last Tuesday afternoon, I think, around 1 o'clock, that we were informed that school would not be happening the next day.
Okay. All right.
So
you're talking about a short turnaround. Okay. And I'm sorry, yeah. Go ahead. You were going to give me your read on how it unfolded.
I mean, it's one of those situations where it's really hard to criticize the Curley leadership for anything they did, because they were responding as best they could with the information that they were given, with the guidance that they were given, with the staffing and tools that they were given. Obviously, we would have liked, you know, to have more lead time, but if that's not a decision you make and then put off for 2 days either. Once you make that decision, that means it's time to close school. So you're never going to have, like, much more than, I would guess, a 12-hour turnaround on a decision of that nature.
So, you know, I know you know, Department of Elementary and Secondary Education and Commissioner Riley have said, hey, you're planning on 7 days of remote learning. We won't count all seven as qualified instruction. We'll count four. There's been real back and forth on that, especially after the Boston Public Schools have said, we cannot stand up the testing capacity we would need to in time to bring kids back sooner. How are you feeling about DESE, about the state policy here, and how it is interacting with your school?
Honestly, I'm angry. I think DESE is making a decision that is rooted in distrust of our teachers, which I find really disrespectful and not actually fair based on the level of teaching that they managed to provide all through last year and over the entire course of the pandemic. My experience as a parent and as somebody who, you know, pays attention in education spaces has been that they have done an astonishing job, especially with the tools available to them. And in this instance, you know, they had very little turnaround time to throw something together and to pull their remote learning tools back out of the closet and employ them. And I'm just genuinely very grateful to them for the level of instruction that they're able to provide.
And when you say that you think that, you know, the state doesn't trust them, do you mean doesn't trust that they'll deliver the equivalent of 7 days of quality content the way they would if it were in the classroom?
Right. That is what I mean. I mean, I think, of course, you know, the idea that we want our children to be in the classrooms and that's the best possible experience, I don't disagree with that. But I do think, given the parameters and then the, you know, serious public health crisis we find ourselves in, it is unreasonable to cut corners on a quarantine time. And the only, you know, reason I can think of, it just seems rooted in a deep distrust of our educators.
What about concerns about learning loss, special needs students, kids who don't speak English as their first language, and the challenges of remote learning for them?
Sure. Yeah, I don't want to be, you know, dismissive or flippant about those concerns. Those are obviously huge. And those kids especially suffered throughout the course of the pandemic as it, you know, they tried to figure out how to deliver appropriate education to those kids. It's just, you know, in the end, a sick kid can't learn at all. You know, a kid who has COVID who gets really sick, or even doesn't get really sick, but just loses that sort of attention ability, or who ends up with long COVID even, that's going to impact their educational experience as well. And so I just think you have to do your best to keep the kid healthy first and above everything else.
So I don't mean to be glib with this next question, but as a parent with, you know, your experiences with your child, is there a number, is there a tipping point where it's too much time at home, it's too much remote learning, and it's worth some risk to be back in school because of the impact of being out so long? And do you know, is that, you know, roughly, is it 2 weeks? Is it a month? Is it half the year?
That is a good question. I mean, I do think that tipping point exists. I think it's probably a little different for each kid, which makes it hard to, you know, administer yeah. to a large school population. I don't think it's 10 days, which is a very reasonable quarantine time, in my opinion. You know, it's definitely not 10 days for my family and my kid. I want to be like cognizant of the fact that for some families, this is a much more difficult thing to do. Less flexible work, you know, or not able to be at home with your kid. That's also part of why I think it's so important that we follow an entire 10-day quarantine period, because for those families who, you know, are going to have to partner with another Curly family and put their kids together, or leave their kids with a grandparent or a neighbor or something like that, that isn't strict isolation, or that don't have the easy ability to get their kid tested after the initial period has gone by, you know, that's part of why we don't cut corners on the quarantine, is so that it encompasses all those parameters and all those families and our different abilities to respond, and keeps all our kids as safe as possible.
All right. That is Krista Magnuson, a parent of a child at the Curly K-8 in Jamaica Plain. Krista, thanks for being on the show. Good luck with the rest of the remote learning.
Thank you.
For the last part of today's show, we're going to talk about COVID-19 and kids ages 5 to 11. In a few minutes, we will talk to a Boston Medical Center pediatrician about how public health officials are helping assuage concerned, hesitant parents, how they're talking to families. But first, we're actually going to go to the Museum of Science in Boston, which has been teaching kids and their families about the power of vaccine for months now, with interactive exhibits. And over the weekend, they kicked it up a notch. They took the interactive lessons all the way to actually vaccinating kids against COVID-19 right at the museum. Radio Boston's Amanda Beland was there and brings us this report on the excitement and the sense of relief on Saturday at that museum's very first vaccine clinic.
Tucked behind the Museum of Science's IMAX theater in the planetarium are rows of tables and chairs. Typically, museum goers would wait here for a show, but today, 5 to 11-year-olds were here to get their COVID-19 vaccine. Mom Elizabeth Taglauer is here with her daughter Alana. For Taglauer, the day couldn't come soon enough.
It's a really special day. I'm a doctor and I do COVID research, and it's just so meaningful to have my daughter here and
fight this terrible virus.
And it looks like 7-year-old Alana is ready for that fight.
I'm wearing a Wonder Woman costume.
Alana was one of hundreds of children who signed up for an appointment on Saturday. For museum president Tim Ritchie, setting up the clinic at the museum was as much about strategy as it was about empowerment.
Young people, children in particular, don't like shots. So how do we take the sting, so to speak, out of that? We want to bring it to the Museum of Science where we can celebrate them and make it something different than a clinical experience, but more of a celebratory experience about their active leadership.
The clinic feels like a birthday party. There are balloons, art stations, and stuffed animals leading up to the poke. Once kids get their shots, they wait in an observation area next to a pair of the museum's musical stairs. Brothers Christopher and Kellen Lockhart got their shots together. They both said they would do it again.
I think it hurt less than a flu shot. I could do this 5 times a year, honestly.
It felt just like the slightest bit of pressure, and then boom, it was over. So not that bad at all.
Their mother, Emily, said she was relieved when it was over.
I feel like we're going to be able to do so many things now, and I just hope that more people get vaccinated so we can get out of this pandemic.
Arlene Kellner feels the same. She brought her sons Marty and Walter to get vaccinated. She says watching them get their shots was emotional for her.
I started to get a little overwhelmed. I teared up at the end, just this sort of big sense of relief. And seeing how many people came together to make this pleasant for the kids after they've had to give up so much the past few years really touched me.
Kevin Turner, Chief Operating Officer for Cataldo Ambulance, says he's hearing that relief a lot from parents. The company has been running vaccine clinics for almost a year now with no sign of slowing down.
What amazes me is I thought we'd be done by September, October, and we're still going, and I'm booking clinics now for pediatrics even into January. So it's been a long year.
Back by the musical stairs, Jennifer LeBon walks with her 5-year-old son, Hayden, who just got vaccinated. Hayden is a little shy when I ask him about the shot, but Jennifer fills in the blanks for him.
And now we're saying that Hayden's got his superpowers, so we're very, very proud.
That report from Radio Boston's Amanda Beland. The second clinic of its kind will be next week at the Museum of Science, a third scheduled for December. And to be clear, I would get the shot 5 times a year, too, if every time I got to walk on the musical stairs afterward. That was delightful. Okay, we're going to turn now to Dr. Eileen Costello, who is chief of ambulatory pediatrics at Boston Medical Center, is leading vaccine clinics for kids there. You may also remember her from our Ask the Doctor segments. Dr. Costello, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So I am tickled by vaccines at Museum of Science, and I wanted to give you a chance to react to that, too.
I'm totally tickled also. It is just, that was such a fun segment to listen to, the voices of kids expressing, you know, oh, it's not that big a deal, and their parents. And I just think the emotion in the parents' voices was really powerful. Kids have lost a lot in the last 20 months, and this is our way to dig out of that. And so I think it's just wonderful that the Science Museum is doing it, making it fun, and that kids are like jumping on the bandwagon that this is our way out.
How do you coax a shot into a scared kid's arm?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And, you know, there are some kids who are truly, you know, phobic or really scared about vaccines. We have a lot of strategies that we use. In our clinic, we use like a cold numbing spray on the arm so that it's less, the child can't feel the vaccine because they're too busy feeling the coldness. Or we have little devices, little buzzers, things that will sort of distract the sensation from the shot while the child is focusing on something else.
So I got to believe that parent angst is a very different thing. And I think I am picturing that parent in the parking lot in their car who knows they probably should get their kid vaccinated. They're scared of the unknowns about the vaccine. Mm-hmm. What do they need to hear to get out of the car, enter the building with their child and get their child vaccinated? What do you tell them? What do they need to hear?
It's such a great question because there really is a lot of hesitancy and anxiety. And I think because parents feel like, well, the 5 to 11-year-olds aren't really getting that sick, you know, why should I take any risk at all? But I think our response to that is the risk is very, very small of the vaccine. The risk of the illness is still significantly greater than the risk of the vaccine. We are not seeing major side effects to, you know, in any large numbers of kids in this age group. And we are really aware that they have lost a lot and that this is their way to get back to school, to get back to playing with their friends, playing on teams, singing in the choir, the kinds of things that we know are good for kids.
Is there a particular family, a particular encounter or conversation you've had that sticks in your mind?
Oh, there are so many. I think I recently saw a family who had lost a grandmother to COVID and had kids in the 5 to 11 year age group and were still so so fearful of the vaccine, even having lost a family member to COVID. And so I think the fear and anxiety and hesitancy in certain groups runs very, very deep. And it really is our responsibility as physicians and public health experts and museums like the Science Museum to educate people, because we're fighting the tide of social media as a source of truth for a lot of people who aren't reading the CDC or listening to the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations.
So I want to be thoughtful and careful here because I also don't want to spread misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
But what are people so afraid of? What is scary?
I think the fear is the things that I have heard are what if something will happen 10 years down the road if I give my child this vaccine? And so there has never been any vaccine in human history that has caused a side effect 10 years later. So there's no reason to believe that that would happen with this vaccine. The fact that it was developed so quickly is another thing that people cite as a source of their anxiety. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at that. One is that this technology, the mRNA technology, has been studied for a very long time. And also, this is a global pandemic, the first in our lifetime. So all the resources of the world were focused on the development of this vaccine for the first time in history. So it makes sense that it would have been developed more quickly when you put all of those heads together from scientists all over the world.
So just a couple of things there. First, mRNA technology is the technology used in Moderna and Pfizer, and it is mm-hmm. a dose of the Pfizer vaccine that's been authorized for emergency use for kids ages 5 to 11, just to clarify. You know, you said there's never been a vaccine that has had a side effect 10 years later. I guess I'm curious, has there ever been a vaccine where we had 10 years of data before we either authorized it for emergency use or approved it?
Not that I'm aware of.
So that's always the case, that if you're taking a vaccine, there's a really good chance, if it's at all new, that no one knows what's going to happen 10 years from now. That is not unique to the COVID-19 vaccines.
That's right.
So why are we so much more afraid? Why are parents so much more afraid of this one than others that have been fairly new, like HPV, let's say, which is fairly new?
Right. HPV is fairly new. There was indeed a lot of vaccine hesitancy on the part of parents about the HPV vaccine. We now routinely give that vaccine at 9 and 10 years of age, and because children will get better immunity if they get it a little bit earlier. And I think that enough people have gotten it that most parents are willing to protect their kids. It's one of the few cancer-preventing vaccines that we have. So I think new vaccines create fear for people. And I think we have a climate of mistrust. And even, you know, I feel even with my own patients that I've known for a very, very long time, it's sometimes really an effort to convince people that I would never do anything to knowingly hurt their child, and that my job and the responsibility of our entire profession of pediatrics is to prevent childhood illness.
Does that make you sad? I just heard you. Yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
It really does. I mean, I think, you know, I went into pediatrics with a mission to improve child health. And I think that's what most of, certainly the large number of pediatricians in my practice at Boston Medical Center are really driven by, the mission of improving lives for kids. And in my life as a pediatrician, 30 plus years now, we now vaccinate against illnesses that I saw very routinely in my training, devastating infections that we now vaccinate against, and we don't hardly see them anymore. And our new young pediatricians in training, it's not on their radar because we have waged these hugely successful vaccine campaigns that have really changed the outlook for a lot of kids in America and around the world. So it does make me sad to think that we've worked so hard to get where we are and that fear is outweighing the science.
At the same time,
and trust.
In listening to you, I guess I wonder two things. One, it almost sounds as if time will take care of some of this. Enough kids will get vaccinated. It will be fine enough times that the remaining parents who are worried will be less worried. And I guess the flip side of that is, how do you do the outreach, especially to communities that had been historically under-resourced or had fewer areas of access to medicine, to get them in and hit that critical mass of vaccinations?
Right. I think that's such a wonderful question. And, vaccination clinics like the one at the museum is just fantastic. We're standing up some vaccine clinics in schools. We are having vaccine days and evenings and Saturdays at the hospital for anybody who wants to come in and get a vaccine. And so access is really not the issue anymore. I think pretty much anyone in the city of Boston who wants to get a vaccine could get one fairly easily. It's more convincing people that this is the right thing to do for themselves, for their families, and for our communities.
So it is easy if you have not heard from parents who are having trouble getting appointments for their 5 to 11-year-olds?
No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty straightforward. There are a lot of places you can go on the Boston.gov website and search for COVID vaccines, and it's not hard to get one.
That is a long way from where we were when we first started vaccinating adults, Dr. Costello.
That is true. That is true. I remember people waiting so anxiously to get their vaccines and worrying, I'm not a high risk person. I should wait. But feeling a lot of anxiety about it. So yes, I mean, I think the supply, at least for us in the United States and certainly in Boston, is great. And we should take advantage of that so that we remain one of the most highly vaccinated states in the country.
Just briefly, do you see a time in the future, a couple years down the road, every fall a kid lines up and they get a flu shot and a COVID booster?
I do.
All right.
I do think that that will become the new normal for us.
All right. That is Dr. Eileen Costello, Chief of Ambulatory Pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Costello, it was a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow. We'll be back here for more Radio Boston.